April is National Bilingual and Multilingual Learner Advocacy Month. That's why we're so excited to tell you about a new special series from Science of Reading, the podcast, that will launch later this month. Over several episodes, we'll talk to leading researchers and practitioners about how the science of reading serves multilingual and English learners, and how to best use the science of reading to support those students in the classroom. That's all starting at the end of this month. Stay tuned to this feed for more.
These are challenging times, and we respect your unwavering commitment to your students. At Amplify, we are working especially hard to support you. And as we all grapple with what it means to focus on the science of reading in a new world of remote learning, we're committed to walking with you through the unknown. Welcome to Science of Reading, the podcast. I'm your host, Susan Lambert. Join us as we talk with experts to explore what it takes to develop joyful, confident, and capable readers. Today's special guest is Larry Berger, Chief Executive Officer here at Amplify. In true Larry form, he provides perspective on education in the midst of school closures. We talk everything from technology to remote learning options to the love of learning and reading. I'm excited to bring this episode to you. Good morning, Larry. Thank you so much for joining us on today's episode.
Thank you so much, Susan. Delighted to be here.
As you know, we always like to start out with sort of the who am I story for our listeners. So how would you like to share with us a little bit of your who am I story?
So I have always been interested in education. I have sometimes confessed to people, and here I am doing it in public, that when I was a kid, I collected textbooks while the other kids were collecting baseball cards.
Oh, my.
And, you know, which is great because no one's competing with you for textbooks when you want to collect the 1971 Addison Wesley. You're the only one asking for it. So I would read them to try to understand how did different people teach different things in different ways. And that led to a bunch of different experiences trying to make education products and eventually to writing a book with a bunch of kids about how to write poetry with young kids. And that then led to starting up an education company that is now Amplify.
Wow. And there's so many more questions I have about this textbook collection, but really quickly, do you still have that textbook collection?
I have some of them. And really kind of amazing, you know, the time that I was collecting was when diversity was first starting to show up in textbook products. So I have one that's kind of amazing. It's an all-white family doing something, then an all-black family doing something. And then late in the book, there are actual white kids and black kids playing together. And wow. That was kind of radical for its time.
Yeah, really interesting. And so where you are now is, for our listeners that don't know, maybe just a quick story about the making teachers' lives easier by putting an assessment on a handheld device that used
sure.
to be called the Palm Pilot that, I don't know, we can still get them at garage sales maybe, I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, they're on eBay. my co-founder and I, who started the company that became Amplify, we were both interested in educational technology, and we had this idea that this new generation of mobile devices, at the time it was the Palm Pilot, were going to be more useful to teachers than desktops or laptops, or at least differently useful, because teachers move around a classroom, teachers want to be able to sit with kids, and they often want a little bit of computing support on the corner of the desk, not a computer in between their interaction with kids. So we started building things on Palm Pilots for teachers. And the one that really took off was observational reading assessment. So these were the ability for teachers to sit down and do assessments like the Dibbles assessment, the Texas Primary Reading Inventory, And we took those protocols, and instead of doing them on paper or in notebooks, we put them on the Palm Pilot. The Palm Pilot did all the calculations and uploaded the data, and suddenly early reading assessment was brought into the digital data-rich age, and we saved teachers a lot of time in how they administered those assessments and really enhanced the amount of data that was available to the system about how we could support the kids that those teachers were teaching. And so obviously the Palm Pilot moved on and our technology has advanced. And you know, now we do a lot of things, not just around the assessment, but around the intervention and the curriculum. But it all started with trying to figure out, was there a way to use mobile devices to save teachers time?
That's great. And this whole idea of using technology in a way to inform not just teaching, but to inform learning, kind of uniquely positions you, I would think, in our current situation as we're talking about having to leverage technology a lot as it relates to COVID-19 school closures. So I wonder how you're thinking about our current situation that we have.
Well, usually the changes that technology brings to education happen slowly. There's some early adopters, there's some middle adopters, and over sometimes 5 or 10 years, a technology becomes part of the furniture in K-12 education. The COVID-19 crisis has suddenly created a world where the time frame of that change is days and weeks, not even months, let alone years. And that is an amount of disruption, but also an amount of innovation and change and people experimenting that is in every sense a crisis, meaning this isn't the right way to do it. But and we would have liked to have a plan and to have time. And frankly, we'd much rather have kids in school than learning remotely. But people are scrambling. And in that necessity, there's been a lot of invention that some of which may stay with us for a long time.
Yeah. And I know the activity that we're seeing is really quite amazing because it's not just coming from, you know, the traditional educational suppliers, I would say, but it's really rallied a whole kind of community that typically sits outside of the education system.
It has been really compelling. The big tech companies have realized they have a responsibility both to help close the digital divide, get access to more students so they can participate in this transformation of learning that is underway. And that means both the people who make the devices, but also the people who provide the connectivity, the cell phone carriers, the cable companies. And everyone's trying to play their part in getting connectivity and a device to the kids who need them. And it's not going to be easy. There are real equity issues, but I like the fact that in most places they're jumping in with 2 feet to say we're going to figure out how to keep some form of school going, and we're going to solve case by case, neighborhood by neighborhood, the digital divide issues where kids don't have access. And so there's so much for us to learn about how to do this well, but I have been blown away by the amount of energy and innovation I've seen in different parts of the country. And one of the projects I've been really thrilled to be part of from the beginning is this thing that is called Wide Open School. If you haven't seen it, its tagline is school is closed, but minds are wide open. And it is exactly what you described. It's a bunch of the big tech companies, Google and Zoom, and a bunch of the folks who provide the connectivity, Comcast and Verizon, and they are all coming together with publishing players like Scholastic, like Amplify, like Abrams Books, like Smithsonian, like Nat Geo, and some of the media companies like Noggin. And there's actually dozens of partners who are joining. And they also include things like the NBA, trying to figure out how to get their players, helping gym teachers teach gym class. And so that's the kind of thing when I say there's been a really energetic coming together of people trying to solve problems in different ways. this is absolutely what we're seeing. And I'd love to get back to ordinary school as fast as possible, but there's a moment of necessity, and necessity brings innovation.
Yeah. Isn't that the truth? And it's kind of exciting that in the midst of a crisis with, you know, education doesn't always get the highlights that it needs in whether it's media or, you know, in politics, it's encouraging to see this crisis is rallying around students, or the response, I should say, to this crisis is really rallying around students and education. And so the wide open classrooms that you're talking about, we will link our listeners in the show notes to that site. Can you tell me a little bit more about when that launched, what's happening with that?
Yeah, so it's called Wide Open School. It will launch, I guess by the time this podcast is playing, it will have already launched. And it will have a few things that people are telling us they need. What they want is a collection of resources that they know are high quality. And one of the great things about Wide Open School is the organization Common Sense Media, who lots of parents and teachers trust to vet the quality of resources for kids. They are serving as the curator and the harbor master for all of these different entities that are raising their hand to help kids. So there's a kind of indication of quality. And then you can go in and you can say, I'm a parent, or I'm a teacher, or I'm a kid. You can sort out what age group you are in, and high quality resources will pop up that you can click out to from other sites, or sometimes it'll be new stuff just on Wide Open Schools. And then there's also daily schedules. One of the things that parents and teachers have told us is that the burning issue of how do I get a daily schedule put together each day with things that are gonna keep my kid learning, keep them motivated. And for lots of parents who have to work, the issue that they might be able to be engaged without hands-on support from a family member is also a really important part of it. So, but every day we are learning more about what teachers and families are asking for, and Wide Open School is trying to be the place where the world comes together to solve those problems.
Well, that's really exciting. And one more quick question. Was this something that was sort of being talked about anyway, and it sort of accelerated the development, or was this really truly a response to the COVID-19?
It was really truly a response to COVID-19. And it's funny, Susan, you and I are old enough that when I say it's like a We Are the World moment, that we know that this is in reference to a moment when the sort of pop music industry came together during a time of famine in Africa and raised money for that. This is the whole field coming together, trying to, it's not this time about raising money, it's about putting the resources out there that kids and teachers need.
Yeah, exciting and very encouraging in terms of.
And I will tell you, Susan, if it's okay, that one of the resources that we found is this woman filming read-alouds from her basement named Miss Susan. And she reads these knowledge-rich, very scientific reading approach, but done with a lot of panache, filmed on an iPhone. And for listeners who don't know what I'm talking about, Susan Lambert has, in addition to her podcast stardom, she started to become a read aloud trending star on social media. So you are, and you're not alone. There's lots of people who each in their own way have stepped up to contribute things. I was just looking at the final cuts of a NBA player who teamed up with a gym teacher to teach a gym class from his apartment in Colorado. So there's all kinds of things, and thrilled that you are a part of it too.
Yeah, and you know, as I was learning and other folks were learning, is And I think I hear you reference this often, is the idea that you don't have to have things perfect, right?
Yes.
My basement, the apartment building in Colorado, wherever you are, that just getting good things out without trying to have perfection is just impactful.
I think that's exactly it. I keep telling the people working on wide open schools that low production is the new high production, meaning not fancy video, just being on your iPhone, not perfect sound, just just talking and not having all the graphics and manipulatives and things you might want to have in front of you, and asking kids, viewers, whoever it is, to use their imagination sometimes for the thing that you don't have in your apartment or your house, and they are experiencing the exact same thing in their world, where certain things they'd love to have. So in some ways, part of the fun and the deeper message of that gym class that this NBA player does is he doesn't have a basketball hoop in his apartment. He's sheltering in place. And so just like you, he's tossing socks into a hamper and balled up pieces of paper into the trash because he's just as frustrated at not having what he needs.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think we're going to talk in a minute about what you're hearing across the country, but I'm sure many people are experiencing sort of this loss of culture or this loss of connection. And I think the natural communication and videos that are not high production value help make some of that connection again, that humanness, if you will, of what we're trying to communicate.
I think that's exactly right. That people are learning in this moment, when you used to be surrounded by people and have people on video, you might not have appreciated the idea of connecting with someone on the screen quite the way that I think people do now, because this is the way they are connecting to the world and connecting to friends and connecting to teachers. And I never want to say that sentence without also saying, and we've got to solve the problem of the set of kids who aren't able to make those connections or are sharing one smartphone among, you know, four siblings and a parent. And so there are a lot of different ways that this is playing out, but I think everybody who's raising their hand to say, I'm going to start making stuff for kids, I'm going to take the lessons that I'm teaching to a few kids and put them online for other people to use as well, we're just seeing some great stuff come out that way.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And so maybe we can segue just a little bit to, you know, you talk with folks all around the country. So what other things are you hearing in terms of our situation?
I think we're seeing a lot of different models of what schools and parents are trying to do right now. There are some places that have said, hey, we're just extending spring break a little bit longer to try to figure out a plan and to figure out what we're going to do. There are others who are saying, let's circulate some links, some activities, some materials. When kids aren't connected, let's send home a packet that are not school as we know it, but keep people doing education activities. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily aligned to standards, but just keeping kids connected and engaged. And then there are places that are saying, we're going to roll up our sleeves and deliver school, and we're going to go on Zoom or Google Hangouts or Microsoft Meet, and the teacher's going to be there and the class is going to be there, and we're going to teach kind of the way we always did, but obviously not in the classroom. And then I've seen some places that have said, maybe the most important thing right now is just human connection. So there's one set of charter schools that at the beginning, the teachers just called the kids one at a time, talked to them for a few minutes. That was in lieu of school. That same place now has a really rigorous school, but is still calling the kids, checking in with them, making sure that they're okay, and especially trying to detect if any of them are in particular need, because they're in New York City, where sometimes a good example would be there can be a family where both parents are doctors. And that we didn't think of that as a kid who was disadvantaged and in need. But in that moment, that kid has both parents disappearing and maybe not able to hug them when they come home because they're quarantining. And so there's a lot going on out there that people are grappling with.
Yeah. And then in terms of learning with all of those varying situations, in your opinion, what's the level of expectation we should have for students or for our kids?
You know, I love to think of myself as a high expectations for kid person.
Yes,
but
you
right
are.
Now, I sort of feel like the way to be a caring educator is the reverse of what it is most of the time, which is really low expectations for anything specific to happen in learning. So high expectations for connecting with kids, high expectation for supporting them. Someday we'll get to high expectations for the academic rigor of what they're doing. But for now, let's get them motivated. Let's get them engaged. Let's let them feel connected to their teachers and their classmates in whatever way we can. And maybe this is a time for more creative work, more project work, more exploring something you've never known about before. And maybe it's not the place to make sure that we're marching through the standards to get kids ready for the test, because it's looking pretty clear that in all or most of the country, there isn't actually going to be a test this year. And so maybe this is the moment to broaden the horizons of kids in ways that attract their imagination, that help them relax. But maybe this isn't the moment for marching through the standards. And I realize I'm saying that on a podcast about the science of reading.
That you are. So given that this is a podcast on the science of reading, what then is the place for science of reading during all of this disruption of the pandemic?
So it's a great question. And I think that a lot of the things that are built into the idea of the science of reading really depend on a classroom, a human to a teacher-student interaction that is face-to-face, and the structure that enables one to move systematically through reading skills and watch how they build and think dynamically about grouping. And that stuff is going to be really hard for a little while. I think we might need to lean on software that helps with skills. There's some pretty good programs out there that do work on phonics, phonemic awareness. In general, the results from those programs aren't great unless teachers are involved too, or in the case of what we're living through now, families are involved too. But I think the hope that you might systematically teach foundational skills in the way you did when you were a classroom maybe might take a little bit of a back burner. And the thing that might take a front burner is the love of reading side of being a reading teacher. And again, I say that as someone who's passionate about the science of reading and doesn't think that they're in conflict, meaning a great classroom does both. Right. But this may be a moment to rotate a bit towards getting kids who are at reading stage curled up in a corner of wherever they're sheltering in place, reading and reading in an extended way and turning the screens off and seeing reading for the journey, the escape that it can sometimes be. And this may be the moment to cultivate that. But also what you're doing in your basement, the read alouds for the kids who are not yet ready to curl up by themselves, and the energy and fun that can come from that. And so, you know, whatever it takes to help families and kids inspire readers to read, and then of course do what we can to remediate the skills that are missing, and you know, reading teachers we'll have to solve for how do I do this when it's not as easy to make dynamic groups as it usually is. And then the one thing from the science of reading that I would like to hear people talking about more right now is the argument about knowledge that at the heart of improving reading comprehension in elementary school may be helping kids systematically develop bodies of knowledge. And again, in a classroom, you might be able to march systematically through a sequence of domains, as we do in core knowledge language arts. But if you're not in that context and you're not able to recreate online a classroom, the next best thing may be just choosing any body of knowledge. There's a kindergarten teacher in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who teaches her kids all about penguins all year long. By the end, they know how to name 30 plus species of penguins. And the thing is, what they're getting from that is how a coherent body of knowledge holds together. And it may not matter if it's penguins or the history of baseball or herb gardens. It's that they are connecting dots among lots of different sources of knowledge and building them into a construct where there's an area they feel they've mastered. And right now, in this moment of remote school, I see a lot of scattershot stuff. Do this in the morning, that in the afternoon, then play this game, then read this book. And that's great. As I said, I have low expectations for now. Whatever is working is good enough. Or whatever's almost working is good enough. But one tip for parents and teachers may be, think about the coherence of those things. Try to pick a theme and just explore it in every way you can, in poetry, in image searches, in reading, in projects, so that kids feel the magic of coherent knowledge, because we know how important that is to future reading.
Yeah, In my experience, kids are the ones that grab onto those ideas, right? They'll get super interested in a particular topic and ask you questions about it all day long. So it seems like great advice to sort of capture that idea and that spirit in this time.
I think that's right. I think it's a lot of things have been dislocated and disconnected for kids. So maybe some new fascination where they are connecting dots and connecting with families and teachers could be a nice antidote to that.
Yeah. And you can even write about that stuff too. Did you know you can learn about it, you can read about it, and you can write about it. And that makes a great connection.
That's a great point.
So large urban districts, underprivileged districts, are obviously facing significant challenges now that schools are closed. What advice do you have for those educators, parents in those places where this transition to remote learning has really been a challenge?
I think it's different for parents and teachers, and it's different in all kinds of settings. But what I would say is focusing on creating a few moments of connection between kids and their classmates, between you as their teacher and kids, may be the most important thing right now. And by moment, I mean, it might be okay to do 20 minutes of instruction over the phone if kids don't have connectivity. It may be enough to simply call kids and ask what kind of help they need. It may be enough to send a packet home and say that at the end of the week, I'm gonna follow up so we can talk about this. I think there are all kinds of things that people are doing. And all I would say is many people are really struggling under the expectation of heroism that that might seem to apply, that they should be teaching wonderfully over a computer on day one for 6 hours a day. And I just think that's not realistic, and that this is a moment to figure out high quality connection-based activities, things that kids can do with a lot of independence, and to know that other people are solving other parts of the problem. And so other folks are working on how do we get, like this project, Wide Open School, more resources easily curated for different age groups of kids, so you don't have to do all of that yourself. But make the part that you do high quality, and look, kids are going to be watching a little more television movies, playing games than might have been their media diet in the ideal world. But that's in part because we're giving time for educators and school systems to close the digital divide and to get their plans in place. And one way of thinking about this as kind of an educational moment is, if something as catastrophic as what the country is going through right now and what individual families are going through right now happened, and the next day all of the teachers were online teaching as if nothing changed at all, on the one hand, we might admire the commitment to educational continuity. On the other, we might be teaching a foolish lesson about life. Like, one of the things kids learn is, wow, when the whole world changes, adults take a while to think this through, to come up with a plan, to try to make that plan work a little bit, and eventually to build to the moment when that new plan is working a lot. If kids don't see adults in this moment improvising, being flexible, changing their expectations, they may be taking a really weird lesson about what to do when crisis hits in their own futures. And they may not be learning the power of stepping back, reassessing, trying to get a few things in order, and then trying to build from that. And so I think there's a lesson about how to deal with crisis that in some ways kids may be learning even more profoundly than the particular lesson about fractions that we are teaching them in new and remote ways.
I love that. That is really powerful and something I actually hadn't thought about till right this moment. I've been thinking a lot about educators and how they need to cut themselves a little slack too, to say, we know actually don't have this figured out and nobody has this figured out. So it's okay for us to just take the next step that we can take. Or parents who are thinking, wow, I'm a teacher maybe, or some educator, I'm also a parent, and I can't figure out how to help my own kid because there's either too many things out there to curate, or I don't have time to do it. And so we're kind of all in this learning moment, and I love that, you know, sort of spirit or essence that let's let this be a learning moment, both for ourselves, but also for our kids, that they can experience this as well as a learning opportunity in a different way.
Yeah. I think people are gonna learn a lot about improvisation, flexibility, changing routines. And then, you know, as a country, we're gonna be solving major problems for years to come as a result of this. And so kids should experience it as a really big change that is significant and that the adults are step-by-step figuring out, rather than kind of let's sweep this all under the cover and, hey, we're back at school, we're just on a computer, but don't worry about that. Let's, you know, turn to page 25 and get started. I think this isn't the moment for that. But we might be a couple weeks away from the moment where we want business as usual to get started again.
So I know one of the things that I've admired about you for a really long time is this thought that your goal has always been, how can I help you, teacher? I understand you have a very important and complex job, and I, Larry Berger, want to help you sort of solve the things that are happening in the classroom to make your life a little bit easier, but also your instruction more effective for students. So what message would you give to teachers about helping their students, or just maybe in generally during this crisis?
So I think it's a lot of what I said. It's okay for your expectations to drop a bit while we figure this out.
Yeah.
But maybe your expectations of connecting with kids, with your colleagues, with their families, it's a time for connection. And then I would say that the other thing that I am getting interested in are all of the asynchronous activities that work in remote learning. I have become increasingly interested in all of the asynchronous learning experiences that remote learning can enable. By asynchronous, I mean we're not all online doing it at the same time in the same way, like you might on a video conference, but I give you an activity and you take your own time to make progress in it, and different kids are interacting with it in different ways and it builds. So I'll give you one small example. And this would work with older kids. I post a poem and I ask kids to highlight using the commenting function in a application like Google Docs or Microsoft has a Office 360 as a version of this, where you can, lots of kids can be in the same document, and you just invite kids to make comments about things they observe, and also invite them to post questions, and then encourage the class, if a kid has a question, maybe another student can answer it. And I've seen some amazing things where a class discussion that is in some ways better than the class discussions that I sometimes see in a physical classroom, because maybe the shy kid who isn't sure feels comfortable formulating an analysis when they can do it in their own time, in their own words. And so the understanding of that poem is deepened through lots of kids collaborating on this document. And it's important to say the teacher didn't have to keep the momentum going the whole time. They didn't have to teach for 30 minutes. Again, there are lots of kids who need much more handholding, and I'm not saying that lesson would work for everyone, but there are shared whiteboard programs where you can collaboratively draw a picture and everybody can make their part of it. And those kinds of things, I think, are a new kind of learning experience for lots of kids. So they kind of get into it and enjoy it. But they also enable teachers to use time differently. You can set the project in motion. And maybe that is the moment that you reach out to an individual kid who needs help. Or maybe that's the moment where you deal with the fact that your own kids are at home and you need to make them lunch. So finding ways where you sort of set kids in motion doing something and then check back with them 20 minutes later or an hour later, I think is a type of teaching and learning that could really thrive in this moment. And I'll say once again, for the kids who can get connected, and we just have to keep shining a light on the fact that there's a big need in this country to get all kids connected so they can participate in learning experiences like that.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I've seen memes going around, well, on lots of different things, but the ones that particularly hit me are about the introverts versus the extroverts, and somehow thinking that this must be the introverts' sort of time and place, because we all have to be sort of stuck at home together. But in seriousness, it's the idea that in the classroom, once we get back there, maybe this can be a time that teachers can start to think about engaging those kids that maybe don't like to be involved in a whole group conversation, or like you said, need to take a little time to think about and process and write before they want to share their ideas. So learning those tools would be, and this is an interesting time to explore some of those.
I think we're going to see different sides of kids come out through this. And when I think about, my wife is a novelist, and the number of her writer friends who had something traumatic happen in their childhood that left them in a situation where books became the place that they escaped into. Mm-hmm. And through that, they began to love language and literature and reading, and now they are writers. And I don't like the trauma that kids are going to be going through, but I do like the possibility that maybe this gives them time and space and opportunity to discover reading as a gift that gets human beings through difficult times. And we might find that kids you didn't expect to become your best ELA students, if they find reading during this time, important things could happen. And yeah, I think the idea that introverted kids may share things online in chats and group discussions that that they wouldn't have shared in the classroom may bring other kids and their ability to the fore. Absolutely.
Let's talk just quickly about parents then and caregivers that are trying to navigate a lot, working from home, parents maybe working from home, homeschooling, just a lot more demands than we've ever had. What can we do to sort of enlist parents to support in these learning opportunities?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing I would say, and this is now back to the teacher, sort of what you were asking before, but it's part of it is, you know, the number of times that I've seen charming online lessons happen and then the teacher gets photobombed by her four-year-old who is, and like, it's actually kind of great because the kids are seeing a version of their, like what's happening in their home, which is that the adults are pulled in a lot of different directions. They're seeing that their teacher's going through it too. And rather than cover it up, I would say to the teachers, like, work with it, live with it. This is going to be a moment where kids get to see a little bit more into your life. And if one of the things you need to do is make breakfast for a hungry kid, take the kids along as you make breakfast and you know, teach them the vocabulary and the sounds of the words and the you may actually be able to turn it into a lesson, and you're also solving the problem of getting your own kids fed. So, I would say, you know, same thing. I think that parents are really willing to help, and parents may not understand that they don't necessarily need to be experts in the domain being taught, but just sitting with kids. If you have a parent who isn't ready to be the teacher themselves, because English may not be their first language, but, the math education expert, Marilyn Burns, always talks about having had a grandmother from the old country, I don't know where it was, who didn't speak any English, but she would say in Yiddish, you know, so yingala, so little child, what happened today? And she had, and when Marilyn, the young Marilyn Burns would answer, the grandmother had no idea what Marilyn was saying because she was answering in English, but she would sit there nodding and listening and seeming engaged. And all I would say is parent engagement, if it's available, is priceless, even if parents aren't prepared to co-teach with you. And then, you know, we have to be really aware of the fact that there are lots of parents on the front lines of this pandemic, whether it's in a grocery store, in the supply chain, or in a hospital. And, you know, we can't count on the fact that that any of our families are stable right now, and especially the ones that have been on the edge are even more so during this time. And so, you know, if you are a parent who can help, step one is just any level of engagement. And step two is taking some of the burden off the teacher. And I think maybe the most important step is making this a time of exploration and openness to tapping into your kids' creativity. So, because school is not gonna keep them occupied, extracurriculars are not gonna be there in the way they once were. So that moment where kids do an art project for 3 hours, it's kind of priceless to everyone. It works for the parent, it works for the teacher, and it may work for the kid in deep ways that we will learn about someday, which is that kids developed attention spans during this time because they weren't always being, you know, having their channel changed. But that may be idealistic. It may be that what kids get good at is playing video games during this time because that too is something that parents probably need to loosen up and let some of their screen time rules relax a little bit to preserve their own sanity and to again show that they're reacting to what's different about now by loosening up some things, even as they may tighten up other things like keeping clean and washing your hands.
Right. Yeah, it certainly is. It's a time that we don't know what the rules are, and we're all trying to figure out how to do the best thing. So, we just really appreciate your thoughts and your wisdom. And as we sort of wrap up, we'd love for you to share one thing, one point of wisdom, something you want our listeners to think about more. What's that one thing before we wrap today?
Can I do two?
Yes, you can
Okay.
have two.
So the first one is, even in the middle of all the crisis, allow yourself to imagine a newspaper headline in 3 years that is saying there was a sudden leap forward in academic achievement by the kids who lived through the pandemic, rather than what everyone expected would be damage to their educational achievement levels. And as you imagine that, try to figure out, well, what could have made that happen? Like, why would that be the case? And we've talked on this podcast about a bunch of things that might actually be good for kids about this moment. And then think about all the ways that you might be able to reinforce those good things in helping kids as a teacher or as a family member. The other one is, as I've said, my big hope for the science of reading and the love of reading is that this will be a moment where kids sometimes just curl up in a corner with the book in order to get away from it all. And I really believe that could be one of the drivers of my first point, that maybe some good things will come out of this educationally. And the final thought to leave you with is, one of the things that makes kids do that is if they see the adults in their life doing it too. So that moment where all the screens go off and all the remote work and all that stuff that families are struggling with, slows down and everybody curls up with a book. Again, I know I'm being idealistic about what home situations are, but there is often time. Even in a really, really busy and complicated day, to spend a little bit of time in a book. And whether it's reading to kids when they're younger, or just you're on one side of the room reading your book and they're on the other side, I think you owe it to yourself as an adult to pick the book that you are going to read during the pandemic that you've always wanted to read. And the modeling for the kids has hidden power. It's not right away that kids will immediately emulate you in most cases. But if they see that it's working for you, they might begin to think, well, maybe that would work for me. And maybe that is what grown-ups do in difficult times. And that wouldn't be a bad lesson to learn.
For sure. Well, thank you so much again for joining us, leaving us with wise words.
Susan, it's always a pleasure. I'm learning so much from this podcast. Thank you for doing this series.
Absolutely. We're so grateful to our amazing guest today and to all of you making a difference in the lives of students every single day. Be sure to check the show notes for resource links from today's podcast, and we want to hear your stories and successes. Follow us on Facebook at Science of Reading the Community, or if you're looking to help implement the science of reading, send an email to sormatters@amplify.com. Tell us what guests you think we should book, or tell us about the research that really excites you. And be sure to hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. Until next time, I'm Susan Lambert.